Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Libya holds a parliamentary election, and an explosion rocks a Nigerian mall, 8 are killed. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Libyans are voting today for a new parliament as the country seeks to end the turmoil that has persisted since the overthrow of former leader Muammar Gaddafi. More than 1,600 candidates are running for the 200 seats in the new body, with 32 of those seats designated for women. The lawmakers will replace a parliament that was elected in 2012 and that many blame for the lingering instability that included a dispute over selecting a prime minister last month. Some 1.5 million people are eligible to vote today, but those in the eastern part of the country could face difficulty accessing the polls because of lingering violence in the region. Witnesses in Nigeria's capital say at least 8 people were killed when an explosion rocked a popular shopping mall. The blast in Abuja today shattered shop windows and caused a thick plume of smoke. There was no immediate word on what caused the explosion, but the capital has been hit by a series of deadly bombings in recent months. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said today that Russia's leaders must prove that he is fully committed to peace in eastern Ukraine through actions, not just words. But the United States and its European allies are not ready to impose new sanctions on Moscow. Speaking in Brussels, where he attended a meeting of NATO foreign ministers, Kerry said it's critical for President Vladimir Putin to publicly call for pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine to disarm. He also said Mr. Putin must stop the flow of fighters and weapons across Russia's border with Ukraine. Meanwhile, NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says Russia is not keeping its word regarding Ukraine.
I regret to say that we see no signs that Russia is respecting its international commitments. So today we will review our relations with Russia and decide what to do next.
The European Union and the United States imposed sanctions against certain Russian individuals and companies earlier this year. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has rejected forming an emergency government to help the country counter a surge by Sunni Islamist militants. Mr. Maliki said today during a televised address that such a move would go against the country constitution and the results of Iraq's April 30th parliamentary elections. Iraqi leaders say they will meet a July 1st deadline for beginning to form the post-election government. Old rivals China and Taiwan held ministerial-level talks today to shore up relations that were hit by a protest movement early this year. China's top official in charge of Taiwan affairs is visiting the island to scope out its economic and social conditions. Ralph Jennings reports.
China's chief official for Taiwan policy, Zhang Zhijun, met his counterpart Wang Yuqi shortly after reaching the island's main airport Wednesday as scores protested his arrival. Taiwan says it will announce no new decisions during Zhang's four-day stay. His agenda includes chats with common Taiwanese and an opposition party figure. Those meetings are seen as ways to show that relations can work despite protests over a proposed trade pact that opponents worry would boost Beijing's influence over Taipei. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
The U.S. economy shrank more than first thought at the beginning of this year. Wednesday's report from the Commerce Department said the economy shrank at a 2.9% annual pace in January, February, and March. That is much worse than earlier estimates and the worst economic growth figures in 5 years. Economists blame the slowdown on unusually foul winter weather, and many predict the problem will be temporary. A top White House economic advisor, Jason Furman, says data from April and May show the economy is on track to resume growing soon. Football's governing body has opened disciplinary proceedings against Uruguay's Luis Suarez after he apparently bit an Italian player during a World Cup match. FIFA has given Suarez and the country's football association until this afternoon to give their position on the incident and any relevant evidence. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehisu Heeb, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
I believe that the United States did the right thing by bringing the ban on the imports of ivory, because I really believe it doesn't benefit the local communities.
That's the chairman of the Zimbabwe Conservation Task Force, Johnny Rodriguez. His comments come as Harare pushes for the lifting of a U.S. ban on ivory. Details coming up.
Also in the news, a bomb blast rocked Nigeria's capital, Abuja, today, and South African platinum mine workers returned to work after a five-month-long strike.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, a bomb blast rocked Nigeria's capital, Abuja, today as an explosion occurred in the popular Banex shopping center. Early reports from eyewitnesses have not yet indicated the cause of the explosion or possible casualties. One shopper said after a loud blast, people were running from the shops and some had blood on their clothes. Nigeria's civilian populations are daily targets of attacks by bombers and gunmen believed to be members of the Islamist separatist gangs of Boko Haram. Reporter Heather Murdoch is at the scene. A few minutes ago, I asked her about the blasts.
Well, it's not exactly clear what happened in that initially. Different witnesses said different things. Some said that there was a car bomb. Others said that there was a motorcycle that drove by and threw the bomb. But what is clear is there's a huge blast. It blew out 17 cars, and several buildings have lost windows and have been damaged around the whole area. There's glass everywhere. The police told me that 21 people had died and 17 people were injured, and that's just the casualty figures as of yet. The local city minister came by, and he said he was heading to the hospital to count casualties. We talked to some of a local girl who sells local nuts on the street, and she told me all she saw was just a big, huge blast, and two of her sisters were killed instantly.
Has anyone claimed responsibility for this blast?
No one has claimed responsibility. The police have not openly accused Boko Haram militants, which is what everyone widely assumes to be the perpetrators, because they have threatened Abuja before, they have bombed Abuja before and not so long ago. But the police did say an arrest was made. So they have, at the very least, by saying that, have confirmed that this was a crime and not somehow a bizarre accident.
What is the scene like now?
It's quieted down a bit. Some of the soldiers are gone, but it's still very crowded with army and police, as well as police dogs are running around all over the bomb site. Some local people who work and live around are standing around watching, but most of the people have gone, and the crowds that came to see what happened, a lot of them have been cordoned off on other blocks. It's only the people that actually worked here, some of the press and the authorities that are right on the bomb site.
It's pretty chaotic.
I mean, I guess anybody could have made it in here.
Yes. Are people in the local community, are they fearful, or are they just basically trying to go about and finish their business?
No, people are really scared. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable, because the last time Abuja was bombed was in April, and at the very beginning of June. And even that state, and it was the worst bombing at a very crowded bus station, but it was in the suburbs. And where this market is in maybe not the absolute most secure spot in the city, but it's in one of the most secure spots, in the heart of the capital, in a wealthy, upscale shopping district. It's not something we've ever seen before. So it just seems to be people are getting more scared, because this seems to be getting worse and worse almost every day.
That was reporter Heather Murdoch speaking with me from the scene of the blast today in Abuja, Nigeria.
Libyans are voting today for a new parliament. The vote seeks an end to the turmoil that has persisted since the overthrow of former leader Muammar Gaddafi. More than 1,600 candidates are running for the 200 seats in the new body. 32 seats are designated for women. The lawmakers will replace a parliament that was elected in 2012. Many blame those lawmakers for the lingering instability and a dispute over selecting a prime minister last month. Some 1.5 million people are eligible to vote Wednesday, which is today, but voters in eastern Libya could face difficulty accessing polls because of lingering violence there. The militias that helped topple Mr. Gaddafi in 2011 have remained in Libya, carving out their own territories and taking control of key ports that have hurt the country's ability to export oil.
It's 10 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The international human rights organization Human Rights Watch, HRW, today is calling for a Bamako-based special investigation unit to investigate war crimes committed by all sides during Mali's 2012-2013 armed conflict. The organization says that while northern Mali's judicial personnel have returned to the north after being forced to flee during the conflict, these courts investigating war crimes would pose serious security risk. Corinne Dufka is HRW's senior researcher for West Africa. She explained why it is important to establish a special investigation unit.
You know, there have been several different armed conflicts in Mali, and there has rarely ever been accountability for the very serious and grave crimes that were committed during the subsequent armed conflict there. First of all, it's important to ensure that justice is done for these serious crimes that were indeed committed by all sides in order to break the cycle of violence and impunity. Now, normally, the national judiciary, the national court, should be responsible for investigating and holding those found to be implicated to account. However, in northern Mali, there are several mitigating circumstances which would make that difficult. First, you have a very precarious security situation in the north. There have been numerous attacks against the cities in which the judicial system courts are located. So that would make investigations in those areas extremely difficult.
You had mentioned to bring all sides that were involved justice for that. So what parties are we talking about specifically?
Human Rights Watch, as well as other national and international organizations, documented very serious crimes, including war crimes that were committed by all sides that engaged in hostility during the 2012-2013 armed conflict. First, you have the crimes committed by the armed Islamist groups, the several of them that occupied the north for almost a year. Those include the summary execution of Malian soldiers, as well as amputation of civilians within their system of Sharia law. You also have other types of brutality that were committed by the armed Islamist groups and the destruction of cultural shrines. With respect to the separatist MNLA, the Tuareg separatist movement, they were engaged in widespread looting as well as numerous incidents of violation. And lastly, elements of the Malian army were engaged in execution of suspects as well as torture and arbitrary detention and, of course, enforced disappearance as well. So all different sides committed to very serious abuses during the armed conflict.
So far, how many cases are there that this special investigation force would be looking at?
At present, this special unit hasn't been set up. In fact, the court in Bamako is actually looking at some of these cases. But we're urging for this unit to be set up so that the expertise can be concentrated in Bamako and they can begin to, in earnest, start addressing these cases. What we've been very encouraged, actually, in Mali by the interest and the enthusiasm on the part of victims and victims' associations to seek justice for the crimes that were committed. A number of cases have actually filed complaints with the authorities to urge for justice for themselves and their family members. So there is indeed what we could call a hunger for justice, both from victims and family members from all different sides.
Do you have an estimate of the number of people who were victimized during this violence?
But it's difficult to ascertain. But I can tell you one thing, that compared to conflicts in Sierra Leone and Liberia and the Democratic Republic of Congo, the violations are actually a manageable number, which again points to, you know, the potential for a unit like this to really make a meaningful contribution in addressing violence. And as I mentioned, a score of victims have already filed complaints with the authorities. Now, we have a couple different options for ensuring justice. One of them is for the judicial authorities located within the North to actually start investigating these cases. The other option is for a special unit to be set up in Bamako. We believe that the latter is preferable given the ongoing security risks and attacks that have continued to happen in the North, and also because some of these cases are quite complicated and the Malian authorities haven't necessarily addressed them, cases like forced marriage and forced recruitment and use of child soldiers. Furthermore, concentration of investigations in the South would more readily lend itself toward a witness protection unit, as well as doing what we call joinders, bringing cases together instead of investigating them in separate jurisdictions in the North, which would again pose security challenges, concentrating those under one roof in Bamako.
How hard would it be to bring these alleged perpetrators to justice? Are they still in the area, or how would they go about getting them?
Well, interestingly, there have been numerous suspects which we believe are credibly implicated in many of the abuses that we think should be investigated are already in custody. They have been picked up over the last year by the Malian and by the French. These include people who headed up the infamous Sharia law systems in Timbuktu and Gao and elsewhere, as well as some key commanders. So, you know, again, the fact that some of these suspects are already in custody and being held in Bamako, you know, will be investigated for their involvement in armed Islamist groups, you know, might also readily contribute to investigating these crimes.
That's Corinne Dufka, HRW's senior researcher for West Africa. She spoke with me from Rockville, Maryland. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. A bomb blast rocked Nigeria's capital, Abuja, today. And Libyans are voting today for a new parliament and would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237.
Congolese military authorities say autopsies of the bodies of five soldiers returned by Rwanda following a recent border clash indicate that the five were probably executed. Rwandan authorities say the five men were killed in open combat on Rwandan territory. The Congo troops disappeared during a brief border clash in Congo's Kivu province 2 weeks ago. Congo claimed a corporal was kidnapped and shot. Rwanda said he had crossed the border into Rwanda. The clash followed in which four more Congolese soldiers died.
The New York Times says a report by the Washington-based humanitarian organization The Enough Project warns that the government of Sudan's newly reorganized Janjaweed militia may be preparing for a renewal of deadly raids in the Darfur region of the nation. The report is expected this week. Thousands of civilians in Sudan's western region of Darfur were victimized by the armed militias starting in 2003. Villages were burned and women raped by the shadowy Janjaweed. The International Criminal Court, ICC, charged Sudan's President Omar Hassan al-Bashir with human rights abuses as a result of the Janjaweed Darfur campaign. Mr. Bashir has not been brought to trial on those charges. An ICC prosecutor has recently echoed the new concern of the Enough Project. An estimated 400,000 died in the Darfur conflict and more than 2.8 million displaced before a peace agreement was reached.
Well, you have many Darfuris remain in camps for the internally displaced. The UN reported last month that the Sudanese militias destroyed a camp in Kordofan in southern Sudan. In recent months, the government of President Omar al-Bashir has reconstituted the notorious Janjaweed as the Rapid Response Force, RSF. They wear state-issued uniforms and fly the flag of the government of Sudan. They are led by General Major General Abbas Abdulaziz and directly controlled by the National Intelligence and Security Services in Khartoum. Mr. Bashir announced last year that this new fighting force would deal with the continuing rebel resistance in the states of South Kordofan, Blue Nile, and Darfur. A spokesman for the Sudanese government in Washington denied the RSF is simply the Janjaweed in army uniforms. He said the Enough Project and the ICC are reporting only part of the story of Mr. Bashir's effort to crush insurgencies in his country.
Zimbabwe is dispatching a delegation to Washington to push for removal of their ban of ivory. But as Blessing Zulu reports, this may be mission impossible as the Obama administration has tightened screws on the ivory trade.
Zimbabwe has dispatched the ecologist Hilary Tendaupenyu to Washington ahead of a high-level national parks delegation expected to lobby a U.S. congressional panel in an attempt to overturn a ban on ivory sales that it says will lead to the total collapse of the sport hunting industry. The United States Fish and Wildlife Service announced the suspension of imports of spot-hunted African elephant sourced in Zimbabwe and Tanzania in April, saying anecdotal evidence, such as the widely publicized poisoning last year of 300 elephants in Wange National Park, suggests that Zimbabwe's elephants are also under siege. The organization added that, given the current situation on the ground in both Tanzania and Zimbabwe, the service is unable to make positive findings required under the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES, and the Endangered Species Act to allow the import of elephant trophies from these countries. It argued further that additional killings of elephants in these countries, even if legal, is not sustainable and is not currently supporting conservation efforts that contribute towards the recovery of the species. But the Safari Operators Association of Zimbabwe President Emmanuel Fundira says the U.S. ban was done unilaterally.
In fact, that's a fallacy, because if this ban was based on scientific evidence, we would have really wanted to see the numbers. As far as we know from the estimates we have got here in Zimbabwe in particular, is that our elephant population has been growing quite significantly. Our carrying capacity, which strikes the correct ecological balance, should be about 50,000 head of elephants. And as I'm talking to you now, the best estimate we have got is that our elephant population has grown between 175 to 200,000, which means we are more than four times what we can carry.
Fundira says the ban has also affected thousands of rural Zimbabweans who benefit from ivory trade under the Community Areas Management Program for Indigenous Resources, or CAMPFIRE, which is premised on the conservation of wildlife and other natural resources as a livelihood option for rural communities in marginal areas of Zimbabwe.
When these same visitors or adventure tourists are denied the opportunity to hunt elephants, which is part of the Big Five, it means it destroys completely the very, very essence of that industry in terms of its value. We have households which are dependent on their livelihood, up to 800,000 households whose lives depend on wildlife use. These are people who live in areas where they cannot exercise any other economic activity. So these people are now being denied their livelihood.
But when it comes to lifting the ban, Zimbabweans are not singing from the same hymn book, as chairman of the Zimbabwe Conservation Task Force, Johnny Rodriguez, says the ban must be maintained as only politicians and well-connected people are benefiting from the safari operations.
I believe that the United States did the right thing by bringing the ban on imports of ivory, because I really believe it doesn't benefit the local communities.
Rodriguez maintains that Zimbabwe is exaggerating the carrying capacity of the elephants to justify sport hunting.
The last audit that they did was in 1997. And since then, you know, everybody's come up with figures which is underestimated or overestimated.
Environment Minister Xavier Kasukwere says he is confident that Washington will lift the ban, and he confirmed that Harare will be sending a delegation for the third time in less than a year to lobby the U.S. government. The first delegation met Secretary of State John Kerry, and the second met senior officials in the Obama administration. But the Obama administration has upped its opposition against ivory trade. At least 1,165 ivory specimens were seized by U.S. border agents and inspectors between 2009 and 2012, according to the International Fund for Animal Welfare. The administration also destroyed more than 6 tons of seized tusks and carvings at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal National Wildlife Refuge outside of Denver in U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services Director Dan Ash said destroying the ivory was to send a message that the U.S. is keen to stamp out illegal trade in ivory.
We are in crisis. What we saw during just this last year alone is 30,000 elephants killed. This 6 tons of ivory behind me represents about 1,000 elephants. This ivory would generate $1,200 a pound on the international market. So this is extremely valuable material, and we're destroying it today because what we need to do is we need to reduce the demand for these products globally.
Despite a 1999 global ban on commercial ivory trading, the last 5 years have seen a dramatic surge in poaching that threatens to wipe out the roughly 500,000 elephants in Africa, experts say. This is Blessing Zulu.
As it celebrates its 125th anniversary, the Interparliamentary Union, IPU, says it will continue to push for greater democracy, gender equality, and human rights for parliamentarians around the world. In an interview with VOA, IPU Secretary General Anders Johnson reflects on the evolution of his organization as he prepares to step down after 16 years in office. Lisa Schlein reports from IPU headquarters in Geneva.
The Interparliamentary Union was still adapting to changes brought about by the end of the Cold War when Anders Johnson was elected Secretary General in 1998. At that time, it was largely an organization operating on an international level, with two major assemblies and not much else every year. With the 21st century looming, a noticeable shift of focus quickly took shape. IPU became more directly engaged in dealing with problems of parliamentarians in individual countries. Johnson says many of these countries were emerging from conflict and moving toward democracy.
We accompany the parliament. We assist the parliament in developing better procedures, learning how to deal with a multi-party setting, having an inclusive decision-making process, learning the ropes, so to speak, about how a parliament works.
Gender equality and the enhanced participation of women in politics are causes Johnson has championed throughout his career, and it seems to be paying off. When he assumed his post as head of IPU in 1998, only 10% of the world's parliamentarians were women. Now this is more than doubled to 23%. He tells VOA, a parliament without women does not deserve to call itself a democracy.
It makes little sense to have only men dealing with issues of policy, legislation, budgets, etc. It's like you're trying to walk with one leg. It's awfully difficult and clumsy and not very efficient.
Human rights are also high on IPU's agenda. Johnson notes many parliaments are not expert in this area and need guidance on how to protect the rights of its citizens through legislation and other activities. The organization has a human rights committee that shines a light on imprisoned parliamentarians and agitates for their release. The IPU chief acknowledges dealing with dictatorships is an activity fraught with difficulty. But he is convinced IPU does have an impact on these governments because it is an institution of parliaments and legislatures play a powerful role in their societies. Not long after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, organizations in Western countries jumped into Eastern and Central Europe, eager to assist these newly emerging democratic parliaments. Johnson says the IPU made a conscious decision not to enter this competition, but to give priority to developing countries.
So from that very early days, because the same democratization movement was spreading into Africa, our work focused on Africa. And we were very present, for example, in giving support to the new parliament post-apartheid in South Africa.
IPU has been similarly supporting parliaments in Namibia, Zambia, Mozambique, post-genocidal Rwanda and Burundi, among others. However, Johnson notes IPU may once again be forced to shift its focus. He says the turbulence in Ukraine, the devastating war in Syria, the militant Islamist insurgency in Iraq is changing the political landscape in the world. He says these events are complicating efforts to push forward a democratic agenda. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And the way these guys break it, And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiyesu Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.